Tschüss.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. I'm Jen Gulbeck from the University of Maryland, sitting in for Kojo. In the midst of March madness, questions about student-athlete status continue to swirl. College sports have long been big moneymakers for schools and the NCAA, and a growing number of players want greater protection, if not compensation, for their participation. Yesterday, Northwestern University football players passed the first legal hurdle in their bid to form a union, one that would grant them protections extended to employees. Here to shed light on what this ruling means and where it goes next is Ellen Zavian. She's a professor at George Washington University's School of Business, and she's also a lawyer and sports agent. Good to have you here with us, Ellen.
Thank you.
So let's start with the first core question. Are football players or other athletes paid by the university? Are they employees of the university?
Well, according to the NLRB, at the district level, they are employees. If you walk like a duck, you talk like a duck, you are a duck.
That's right. The ruling handed down yesterday doesn't apply to all Northwestern players or even all universities. So who does it apply to, and what are the implications?
Well, you have to start somewhere. So the athletes felt that this was the right timing in the economic sphere, the NLRB board, to really put forth this effort. But I want to explain that this is not the first time they've tried this. This has been going on for about 20 years, trying to organize the student athletes. But what you realize is every 4 years, those athletes then move on to their life.
Right.
So really, this is the first time they've had the opportunity to stick with the core group and develop a relationship with the steelworkers to engage this process.
And so who at Northwestern does this apply to, and what universities does this decision apply to?
So the players that filed are the parties to the action.
Just the football players.
Just the football players at a private institution, and it applies specifically to those parties involved. So the NCAA is actually not a party to the suit.
Okay. Since this ruling applies only to scholarship players, and as we said, so far just to football players at Northwestern, is there any concern that if the NLRB's ruling stands, it sets up a scenario of inequality among players on the same team?
Well, the ruling went into, you alluded to scholarship versus non-scholarship would be the comparison. And so a scholarship athlete was discussed in the opinion versus a non-scholarship. And the non-scholarship athletes were actually dismissed and said, we are not going to rule that they are employees.
Since they're not being paid.
That's correct. And so they're really focused on this core component of those receiving an economic benefit for attending the university, and then the university receiving an economic benefit for their performance.
You can also join the conversation. Do you think college athletes should be allowed to unionize? Tell us why or why not. And what kind of protections would you like to see extended to young athletes at the college level? You can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850 or email us at kojo@wamu.org. Ellen, you note that it's important to consider this decision in the context of both history and where we are today. In terms of prospects for these student athletes, why this decision and why now?
Well, I think it's a wonderful economic period. If you look at players not getting jobs, as students aren't getting jobs when they're leaving their colleges, you're looking at unions being told their collective bargaining agreement has to be redone, as in the Chicago incident. So the AFL-CIO has been moving towards organizing not just unions, but helping trade associations. I recently organized the breakdancers that compete into a trade association. So there's a movement across the country that are looking at independent contractors because employers are firing employees and rehiring them as independent contractors without having to pay workers' comp, medical benefits, and so forth. So there's an environment that this has peaked under. This is not just unto itself got here. And if you look at what they're asking for in the suit, they're really not asking for, hey, I want to be paid to play. They want additional money to be able to survive under their scholarship rules that the NCAA has put forth. They want to be able to cover sports-related injuries. They want a trust fund for medical injuries that will go beyond their college days. And the brain injury issue that's going on and is a hot topic obviously plays a role in that. So this nemesis that, you know, we are looking for to be paid is not even in the lawsuit.
And it might be worth filling in people on what the rights are and the contracts are of these students. We actually covered this issue last time I was filling in for Kojo on the show. And we had some people call in, and we had a lot of people here explaining that these athletes don't have really a right to take jobs outside of what they're playing, certainly if it's related to the sport, that they may have their injuries covered while they're playing for the school, but if those injuries extend past their time at the university, they're not covered. So maybe you could just give us a background of what are the rights and restrictions on these students.
So the NCAA started out with a mission. The mission was student athlete, and I emphasize student coming before athlete. And that mission was to create a well-rounded student athlete. So as we know, if you have sports in your background, you're perhaps more likely to have confidence and growth and communicate at a team level and all those attributes that come with sports. So that was the initial mission statement of the NCAA, which is a nonprofit, let's add. So if you look at that component, how have they grown into a business? They're paying the coaches extraordinary amounts. They're paying the athletic directors not just extraordinary amounts, but they get bonuses based on how well the athletic department does or performs at bowl games and so forth. And the only individual that's not getting a piece of the pie, not the whole pie, are the performers.
Right.
And so what are they asking for? Well, they can work under the NCAA rules, but it's very restricted. And when you're already working 50 to 60 hours a week during the season and 40 to 50 hours a week during the off season, what employer is going to hire you for that 3 hours that you have to do construction work?
Sure.
Okay. And there's a lot of rules and regulations that person has to jump through in order for that athlete to be compensated.
And they can't receive compensation, say, from Nike or other endorsements because that takes them out of the NCAA rules. Is that right?
That's right. So this level of defining amateur has been a struggle from the U.S. Olympic Committee to the national governing bodies of each sport and now to the collegiate level. What is amateur? In some cases, the definition is if you receive Nike footwear, you are no longer an amateur. If you receive clothing, a ride to the hotel from an agent, all those things have a value and therefore you're no longer eligible. So really, you have to look at, is there a need for a definition of amateur across the board in the athletic community?
We have a bunch of people calling in. Let's start with a couple calls. We'll start with Brian in Alexandria, Virginia. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you for taking my call. Interesting topic. You know, I've always thought that the whole college sports student-athlete system was flawed. And to me, the biggest problem has been one of transparency and that there's really no accounting for what the exact value is of what the student is getting in the form of their education or the classes and what the university provides. And we never see an exact accounting of the money that is earned by the university. You always hear about the millions and millions that they earn, but not a specific accounting. I've heard it discussed before. Could there be some sort of a system where the students, the athletes, get some sort of a voucher system where they have to pay for the tuition like every other student, but then they get some sort of compensation from the university that then they can apply towards their tuition. So we take away this what they're getting and what they're paid kind of gray area, because no one really knows. I mean, when I go to college, I knew what my tuition costs, room and board costs. I mean, there was a way to define what it actually costs, but you never hear what that is with the students, and then of course they're not with the athletes, and you don't hear what compensation they're getting, like you said, for their labor, for the efforts, the people that are actually performing get no piece of that pie other than what they get through their this education that they're getting out of it. But that's this nebulous, we never quite know what the value of that really comes down to.
Thanks for your call, Brian. And we also had Gary on the line who dropped off, who had a question about how much tuition was. I had heard a report yesterday, I think, on NPR about these students that said it was around $65,000 a year. But Brian raises a lot of bigger issues, so maybe you can comment on those more broadly.
So, like I said before, the IRS is looking at nonprofits and saying, look, NFL, are you still a nonprofit? You may bring in billions. And there's this thing called unrelated business income tax. The NCAA gets away with not paying taxes on network and television deals and bowl money and ticket sales and merchandise because they're, quote unquote, a nonprofit. So I think the IRS is going to get pulled into this as well. But when you look at the Department of Education's database, that's where the universities insert what they're spending on particular areas. And according to the opinion, the total revenues were $235 million from 2003 to 2012, and the total expenses were $159 million. So there's obviously a difference there.
Sure.
And how you value one extra person in a seat to a university is always has been an issue, even for myself at a university teaching at GW.
Right. Let's take a call from Doug, who has a slightly different perspective. Doug in Fairfax, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. So being a former college athlete, one of the things that I enjoyed about it was the actual participating in the sport. And I played I was a non-scholarship player. And what I see happening, though, is as business encroaches upon the sport, that we lost sight of what the sport was all about and the enjoyment of it. Now, these kids, they go to school, they're getting an education, they're getting it paid for on some level, and I haven't heard a lot of talk about the benefit. And that benefit is directly related to how much they study and the job that they get when they actually finish their education.
Okay, Doug, thanks for your call.
So I would just comment that the athletes are spending an enormous amount of time, as I said, 50 to 60 hours, according to the opinion. And there are also nothing is mandatory in some respects, but if you don't show up, it is mandatory. There are also Brad Scheer has spoken about the issue of social media, and they're mandating that these athletes give their passwords and who they befriend, and they have to befriend the coach. So it's starting to look like an employer is not just looking at what's the best experience on the field, but I'm going to take over your social media. I'm going to ask for your passwords. I'm going to not pay you workers' comp if you get injured. And, oh, by the way, if you're injured and you leave us, you'll have to pay for those expenses. So when you look at it from a total perspective, it really yells and screams, I guess I am an employee.
So there's an argument on the amateurism side, but really also a counter argument on the fairness side, it sounds like you're saying.
Well, if the definition of amateur is allowed to change according to the NCAA, then that changing definition would be the counter argument to your statement that the amateur status, well, what does that mean? I'm trying to figure out what that means.
Sure. So let's wrap up with one last question as we're running out of time. We've talked about how big this business is. Do you think the ultimate end result here will be a change of the business model for the teams and for the universities?
I think my suggestion would be that you sit down and you start discussing increased scholarship monies, better medical coverage, and a trust fund for when the athletes leave, and you'll never have to get to the salary component at all.
Ellen Zavian is a professor at George Washington University School of Business. She's also a lawyer and a sports agent. Ellen, thanks very much for joining us to talk about this.
A pleasure.
We're going to take a quick break and continue our conversation. Stay tuned.
The D.C. mayoral race is heating up, and WAMU 88.5 wants you to make an informed decision using our D.C. voter guide. Go to WAMU.org/vote, enter your address, and select two candidates to compare their positions on campaign finance reform, affordable housing, and other issues. That's the D.C. mayoral race voter guide at WAMU.org/vote.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
WAMU 88.5 listeners are part of an enlightened community. Civil discourse and attentive listening are what gets us closer to understanding both sides of an issue. And that's a public radio specialty. When you know more, you can do more to make a difference. Please help public radio stay true to this mission of providing unbiased, accurate, complete, and honest analysis of events at home and abroad with your membership donation at 800-248-8850 or WAMU.org. Thanks.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Loyola University, Maryland, and its master's programs in Montessori education. The Washington Montessori Institute is hosting an information session April 5th at 10 a.m. in Columbia. Learn more at loyola.edu/Montessori. And from Delcor Technology Solutions, offering consulting, digital strategy, and network support to help associations and nonprofits achieve their goals. Celebrating 30 years of service with 30 acts of appreciation. Delcor.com.
A new playground in the UK upends modern parenting norms and safety trends. Instead of rubber flooring, colorful slides, and ultra-safe climbing equipment, it's got old tires, a fire pit, and a creek. And minimal adult supervision. The idea isn't really new. Until just a few decades ago, kids spent much of their free time on their own, often in environments very much like that UK playground. And parents were a peripheral presence. A new article in The Atlantic explores the dramatic shift in parenting today, including what might be lost when we don't allow kids the freedom to risk and fail. Joining us to discuss is Hannah Rosen. She's a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and author of the book The End of Men. Hannah, it's good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
So this is an issue I think we're going to get a lot of audience interest in. Tell us a little bit about the playground known as The Land.
It is so cool. It's basically looks like a junkyard. I mean, you look there and you think, oh, this is some corner of the world that somebody forgot. It's got piles of old tires and wooden pallets and a creek and this sort of funny looking rope swing. And then the weirdest thing is that there are fires, like kids make fires. That's one of the things they do is learn how. That's what freaks people out the most.
Awesome. Yeah.
But, you know, and the other interesting thing, which is so different from what I'm used to in playgrounds here, no parents. I never saw parents. I was there for a couple of days. My child was the only one whose parent was present.
Wow. And so is there anyone there supervising the kids?
Yeah, they're called play workers and they're trained.
That's a great name.
Exactly. Who wouldn't want that job? It is an actual government job in the UK. You are trained as a play worker.
Oh,
and so
wow.
There's a couple of them and they describe their job as loitering with intent, which means they hang around, you know, make sure nothing really dangerous is happening.
No one starts each other on fire.
Exactly. But
yeah.
They try not to intervene. They don't do that thing that parents do where they like, oh, they jump in when they see something bad is about to happen. As long as it's not, like, really bad or dangerous, they don't jump in.
So you spend a lot of time talking about playgrounds in this piece that you've written, because in many ways they symbolize how parenting has changed over time. Tell us about that.
It's a preoccupation with safety, which has infected playgrounds and lots of other areas of life. So you can track how much playgrounds have changed since I was a kid, you know, since the 70s and 80s. So they've basically been homogenized and they've been concerned with, they've been concerned with keeping kids safe much more than letting them take risks or having them be independent or do things that are cool. And it turns out that kids need to feel like they're taking risks or doing dangerous. They don't need to do dangerous things. They need to feel like they're doing dangerous things.
Right. So you jump off the monkey bars and there's no way you'll probably hurt yourself, but it feels really exciting.
Right. Exactly. And the weird thing is it hasn't made much of a difference. I mean, that was the surprise to me is that all that rubber flooring and this lower equipment and the sturdy slides, like we still have a ton of injuries in playgrounds, just as we did in the 70s.
You can join the conversation as well. How much freedom did you have as a kid? Do you think children are too sheltered today? You can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850 or email us at kojo@wamu.org. There's a playground here in D.C. that's gotten some attention for its equipment, the Beauvoir Playground in Northwest. Describe that playground for us and what makes it different.
That's the first awesome playground we've had in Washington. It is very close to my house, and I'm so happy to have it. It is just I have children ages 13 to 5. I have three. And all of them, there's equipment there that they all like to play on, and that's really hard for them to master. It has a rope swing. Everything's kind of natural. You can climb to high places. It looks very different than any other playground I've seen in D.C.
And is it frequented? Are there a lot of kids going there?
Billions. It's just packed on the weekends. Apparently, after my story came out and I mentioned it, people from Beauvoir have told me that, in fact, the Beauvoir parents, some of them are worried about their kids getting hurt on the playground, which I guess is a natural worry. That's how we think these days. But there, it's packed on the weekends.
We have a poll up right now on whether or not kids are overprotected. You can take the poll by going to kojoshow.org, and you'll see it right there. Hannah, your memories of your own childhood are very different from the way you're raising your own kids. Where did you grow up, and what was your experience with parental supervision?
I grew up in Queens, which is in New York, and my mom just wasn't a part of my play life. Like, I was out on the streets. She didn't make play dates for me. I just kind of ran into people and we played. We used to play in the ball field and we'd play handball. It never occurred to me that my mother would arrange or have anything to do with my free time. Like, she was around, but it was just mine. So there was something, I think, called child culture. And one of the interesting things is after writing this story is how much nostalgia has flowed my way. People just remembering, oh, when I was a kid, this and that happened, or I used to do this, or this was really cool. You know, that's a lot of the reaction that I've gotten to this story.
And that was totally my reaction. And since I have a microphone, I'm going to talk about it. I was reading about your experience, and I had a similar and yet totally opposite experience. I grew up, you know, out in rural Illinois. I played in the woods all the time. I did all sorts of crazy things kind of by myself. And I don't have kids of my own, but as my friends have started having kids, and I know people who do, it's been a complete shock to me that there's all these play dates and things. Like, I kind of thought it was a joke for a while because it was so different. And so it was interesting for me to kind of reminisce back. But this kind of nostalgia that I'm sharing now, that really is a lot of the response that you've gotten on this piece.
Yeah, and I think it's because it's not that parents set out to say, I'm going to be a safety nut. It's not like that. It's just we got pulled on this wave. It's kind of, you know, out there in the culture that we should worry about safety and we should protect our children from any possibility that they would be physically hurt or emotionally hurt or their feelings would be hurt. So we're all swept on that wave. And suddenly, if you get people to sort of think back on what their own childhood were like, that kind of opens a space for us to reconsider our assumptions, let's say, about childhood, to just think a slightly different way about what it means to be a good parent.
So before I move on to the next substantive question, I have a story here about your childhood jail that you created that maybe I could get you to share with us.
You know, I purposely told a story about my childhood that wasn't a lovely, enlightening, rainbow and unicorns kind of story, because I wanted people to understand that I wasn't purely saying the 70s were awesome, because I actually don't want us to go back to the 70s. I was about 9 years old, and my friend Kim and I played cops and robbers a lot through the garages in our Queens apartment building. And so we locked up a bunch of younger kids. Now, locked up means we put them behind like a very low, you could just walk over it very easily. And then Kim and I sort of forgot about them and went to go get pizza, because in those days, you know, at 9 or 10, you could walk down to the pizza store by yourself. And we got back and they were pretty upset. But the weird thing is that none of them left.
They were still there.
Yes. And none of the parents came to intervene. There wasn't any meeting in the neighborhood. Nobody called my mother. And so what I take from that is that there was a kind of respect for the rules of child culture. Like, if we said they had to stay in jail, nobody called their mom. They just stayed in jail until we got back. And there are consequences for that. They were upset. But, you know, nothing happened. We just like said, okay, you guys can go home now. And they went home.
It sounds a little bit like a 9-year-old version of the Stanford prison experiment.
Right, that's exactly what it was. Except, you know, we forgot about them. We weren't like intentionally.
Yeah, you weren't abusing them.
Exactly.
Beyond the base level of locking them up.
Yeah.
So these changes we're talking about have happened in a very short period of time. You note that what was just a few decades ago would have been considered paranoid to walk your third grader to school. And now someone might call Child Protective Services on you if you don't walk your child to school.
Well, that's what's really weird. You know, I think a lot of people my age started to think that maybe we were making up our memories, because it's only one generation. And so that's why I wanted to look up the actual statistics. And it turns out the actual statistics bear out our memories. You know, something like 80 or 90% of third graders walk to school by themselves. No third grader walks to school by themselves now. It's a tiny number. So you have to ask yourself, what is that? What are we afraid of? And why did these habits change so rapidly?
Do you have insights to answer those questions?
Yeah. I think when people say the world is a more dangerous place, they are talking about something pretty narrow, stranger danger. You know, there's sort of a moral panic that a stranger is going to abduct your child. That's one of the things that comes up. When the fact is, a stranger is no more likely to abduct your child now than they were in the 70s. It's not actually a real thing that's increased. you know, what has increased is a sense of neighborhood disintegration. So moms are now not home, they're working. There's a lot more divorce than there was in the 70s. There's a lot less of a sense that, you know, the person at the dry cleaner, or the person down the block knows your child and is looking out for your child. So the world is different, but it's not necessarily more dangerous.
I had this experience where I was probably 11 and my friend and I would ride our bike, and there was a store we could get to about 3 miles away that had a payphone outside of it. And we thought it was great to like prank call these 800 numbers. I had no idea who the woman was who worked at the convenience store, but she knew who I was. And she called my parents, and I got in quite a bit of trouble for that. So that's getting to this neighborhood thing. I think even if you didn't know the adults kind of knew who everyone was.
Yeah, and now the rule is don't talk to strangers. That came around the 70s. You know, everyone tells their kids don't talk to strangers. And in a funny way, by telling your kids that, you're making it worse. Like, you're making it impossible for any adult to watch out for your child or for a community to form in whatever ways it can, because children grow up thinking of the public space as a dangerous place. Playgrounds are dangerous. The streets are dangerous. You know, the public place is dangerous. And the only place that's okay is the privacy of your own home. That's where you're safe.
Yeah. We have a lot of people calling. You can also join the conversation. Did you go outside to play unsupervised when you were a kid? Do you let your children do that today? Call us at 1-800-433-8850 or email us at kojo@wamu.org. Let's start taking some calls. We have James in Leesburg, Virginia. James, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think she probably answered my the question that I have. But I grew up in Africa. I'm an immigrant, and playing as a child is completely different than it is here. Now I have two kids of my own. And I wanted to ask her is it because of the prevalence of sexual predators now, because of social media and, you know, it's like everywhere you go, you hear the news. Does she think that's the reason why parents are now extremely overprotective? Because it's like your kid is part of a soccer team, and you're even scared of what the coach is going to be doing to your kid. Now that I have two kids, I think about it all the time. Does she think that's the reason, one of the reasons why parents are now extremely overprotective of their kids?
Thanks for the call, James. So is this something where there are more predators now, or is it something that we're able to hear about more with social media and the news, and kind of the news fixating on social media is maybe a place this is happening?
The latter. I mean, there are no more sexual abductions than there were in the 70s. There really are not. And yet it's this fear that's in all of our heads that we really, really can't get around. We did it on the internet, too, by the way. When kids started going on the internet, yeah. You know, the initial reaction was, well, they're going to be preyed on by sexual predators. You know, it wasn't that common. It's certainly very uncommon now that everybody's online and kids can kind of find their own social network. So I think it's just a fear that parents have that doesn't have much basis in reality. The only person who's likely to abduct you is your father when your parents are getting divorced. That's the person most likely to abduct a child.
So let's take a call from Brian in Centerville, Virginia. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking the call. I really appreciate it. I have kind of a unique perspective because me and my wife are actually pregnant with our first child. So we have a lot of these
thoughts. Congratulations.
Thank you. Appreciate it. We've been trying for a couple of years, too, so it's pretty exciting. But we've had this kind of worry about, well, this is probably more my worry, not hers, but how when we raise our kid, we give them the freedom, let them take risks, let them skin their knees, let them realize they can pick themselves back up. We love that style of parenting. And it is in contrast, I think, to what you're talking about as far as, this overwhelming feeling of needing, you know, security and safety and keep an eye on your kids 24/7. My sister, God bless her, keeps a close eye on her kids, and she's about 8 years my senior. And I guess my question is, getting into this environment now where I'm going to be a parent and I want to give my kids this freedom. I want them to play down the street and, you know, not have to like worry about every 2 seconds. How is that? I'm worried about being looked upon as being negligent to my kids, I guess. There's a perceived negligence like, oh, what? You're going to let your kids do this? And I mean, there's my family and friends I know who are going to have certain opinions, especially my family, you know, and because they've been, my mom was slightly more protective of me. And I guess what's your understanding of how, is there a way to kind of trump this idea of this of being looked upon as an extra parent. I really just want my kids to run free and have some of the opportunities I had to go out in the woods when I was a kid, you know, and fall down in that creek that was probably sewage filled. You know? But it was a great experience. And I don't know. I just don't know. I worry about that level of negligence I'll be.
Okay, Brian, let's hear Hannah's response on this.
You're awesome. I hope you stick to that. That would be really, really great. It would be helpful. I think you're right that social pressure is the biggest problem. There are lots of reports of, you know, the police being called when they see a child walking to school alone. If you Google that, you'll see places all over the country where people say, oh, my gosh, I let my child walk by themselves. And this is what happened to me. I would say that we can do this slowly. It's not about neglecting your child or going back to the 70s. It's about reconceiving our role as parents as not just protecting our children, but giving them opportunities to expand and know themselves. So think, what is the job of a parent? A job of a parent is, you know, to keep an eye on your child, but also to, say, build their character, you know, give them opportunities to learn about themselves and learn things on their own. So it's just like shifting the job description a little bit. That's what I would hope for.
Yeah, and I do want to put a flag in here. We're covering a story right now about a child abduction here in D.C., Relisha Rudd. We're going to have an update on that at 2. But as you point out, she was abducted by someone she knows. It's also not the case that kids aren't getting hurt, just that they're not getting hurt any less when their parents are monitoring them than they were when they were kind of out free range roaming.
And also, it's our worst nightmare. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why abductions resonate. They have since the turn of the century. They particularly, when the sexual part got added in the 70s, you know, I write about the case where when we started talking about sexual predators was a case of a boy who was abducted in New York. Now, we had no information about who had abducted him, but this idea that it had been a sexual predator just kind of came up in the news, and then suddenly there were all these stories about sexual predators being everywhere. But like, we actually didn't know that. Yet, the single case, like the case that's happening in D.C., you know, it's such a heartbreak. Like, it makes everyone panic. And if you're a human being, you can't help yourself. It's really, really hard.
Yeah. And I've had these discussions with friends who have kids and are talking all about the stranger abduction, sexual abduction. And I've tried to kind of say, you know, it's not that common. And they say, I will do whatever I can do to make sure that doesn't happen, even if that means I watch her every second. And that's kind of, I think, feeding into this trend that you've covered.
Right.
Let's take a call from Carol in Fairfax. Carol, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Well, I was just calling because I think this idea of a less safe, more natural playground is a great idea. My parents never knew where we were. There were 7 of us. We lived in the woods. We would be miles from home. My parents never knew where we were. We had a big brass bell they'd ring. We would all come home, and I kind of applied the same thing to my 5 kids raising them. It's get out there, play, you know, didn't even give them technology. We didn't even have cable until about 3 years ago. My kids are all grown. And I think parents worry too much, and the man who was speaking before, there is a lot of pressure from other parents. My girlfriend and I had the belief of benign neglect with your kids. It's because they have got to have conflict in order to learn how to deal with conflict. They've got to have scrapes and bruises. It's good for them. You know, you just shouldn't worry about those things, I don't think. They're just a natural part of growing up. And kids are so protected these days and so entertained. They don't even know how to entertain themselves anymore because parents are so busy hovering over them, keeping them entertained.
So you parental know, peer just, pressure to entertain your kids and protect them from everything.
And not even I can't even tell you how many parents came to me if my kids were having conflict with another kid and they want to get right in the middle and mediate. And it'd be like, you know, you got to leave them alone and let them figure it out.
Yeah, let's get Hannah's take on this.
Maybe the way to convince the parents is to tell them that there's consequences for all this worrying. Like, they think of it as just a pure positive, but there are actually negative things that come out of it. You know, people talk about the generation, the poor millennials. Everyone beats up on the poor millennials, but there is a sense in which, you know, they leave home and are kind of adrift. You know, you hear about it in cases of increased depression, or you know, there's been lots and lots of stories about that, about how they're having trouble finding themselves and kind of know. You knowing how to center themselves. And I think this does have to do with it, this sense that there's always going to be someone to intervene, you know, that there aren't rough things that are going to happen that you're going to have to deal with absolutely by yourself. Or even the sense of like exploring on your own. That one is really, really hard for parents. But that fear and thrill, which has been in fairy tales forever, is something that kids need in order to grow up, basically.
And we're both professors, and this is something that I think I see manifesting in 18-year-olds who are coming to campus for the first time. I don't have a long enough career there to compare it to how it was before, but I do see a lot of them who seem like they've never really developed these skills of managing crises when they come up, like they expect someone's going to step in and fix it.
Yeah, and then you hear these horrible stories, which I can't even believe, where like parents will call the college about grades,
yeah.
Or parents will even call the first employer, you know? So you really don't want people to get used to that.
Right. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. I'm Jen Gulbeck, sitting in for Kojo. We'll continue our conversation with Hannah Rosen about kids in play in a moment. Stay with us. Coming up at 1, correcting online stumbles. When a mistaken tweet can reach thousands instantly, we explore the media's challenge in dealing with factual errors and other mistakes in the internet age. Today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Jessica Jordan. Stick around for Tell Me More. That's coming up later today at 2 o'clock. A new White House report says raising the minimum wage would for tipped-based workers will be a big help to women. That's all coming up at 2 on Tell Me More.
Hi, Kai Rizdahl here, the host of Marketplace. Think of a number, any number. All right, not any number. If you had 24, you're in luck, because that's when Marketplace is coming to Washington for a special live show at the Strathmore, April the 24th. How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. Everything you need to know about what drives your bottom line. More information at WAMU.org under events.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Krieger Museum, celebrating its 20th anniversary with the K at 20 exhibition featuring 14 Washington area artists. Now through July 31st. More at KriegerMuseum.org.
In northwest D.C., it's 41 degrees now with partly sunny skies. Tonight, mostly cloudy with lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, we'll have rain mainly in the afternoon, highs tomorrow in the lower 60s. Let's get back to the Kojo Namdi Show here on WAMU 88.5.
Welcome back. I'm Jen Gulbeck from the University of Maryland, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. I'm talking with Hannah Rosen about kids and play. You can join the conversation, too. What do you think kids gain from being allowed to fail? If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-433-8850. On the line right now, we have James Siegel. He's Executive Vice President of Kaboom, and I'd like to get some comments from him. So, James, you're on the air.
Hi, Jen. Thanks very much.
Thanks for calling in.
Kaboom, we're best known for the playgrounds that we build in partnership with low-income communities across the country, and our goal is to ensure that all kids get the play that they need to thrive. And I think we have a lot to agree on with Hannah. First of all, how important play is in kids' lives from the perspective of physical development, social and emotional growth, cognitive and creative development as well. And also that kids need challenge in their lives. And I liked what Hannah had to say about expanding their horizons and getting to know themselves and things like that. And the third is that we both love the Beauvoir Playground here in D.C. I was there with my three kids this past weekend and had a blast. And I think the reality of it, though, is that most kids don't get the opportunity to experience things like Beauvoir. And in the communities that we serve, safety is a real concern. It's not just a perceived risk. And we want to make sure that first and foremost, we focus on parents and adults in general, providing love and care for kids and providing a safe space for them to play. Because play enables adults and kids to form connections that are important for their growth. And so I think that the focus on play and giving kids challenge is terrific, and I would just not want to lose out on the importance of adults and parents in providing that environment for kids to thrive in.
And there, this raises an issue where a lot of what we're talking about are kids who have access to spaces that they can play in. And that isn't always the case, right? There are communities where kids don't have playgrounds they can go to of whatever variety. There's not necessarily a place for them to go play.
Hovering is definitely an upper class luxury.
Yeah.
Everything I'm talking about applies mostly to one class. Like everything else in America, play is plagued by a great social divide. So I think the problems in the places where Kaboom builds playgrounds, and I love the Kaboom's work, is are actually the opposite. You know, it's where you have stressed out parents who don't have the time to kind of engage or supervise, and so you want to encourage that rather than what I'm talking about, which is get out of the way.
Right. James Siegel, thanks very much for calling in.
Thank you.
Hannah, one statistic sounds counterintuitive. In most households, both parents today work and kids are now very overscheduled. Yet both mothers and fathers today spend a lot more time with their kids. But it wasn't that surprising when you thought about it.
Well, initially, I read that statistic so many times, it didn't make sense to me. Like, how is it possible that mothers of my generation spend more time with their children than mothers of my mother's generation? It seemed crazy, and yet it shows up in all of the time use studies. But then I thought about it, and I realized that take a typical Saturday or Sunday. I did not spend any time with my mother. I was out on the street, playing the garages, hanging out with my friends, going to the handball courts. I was not hanging out with my mother. Whereas now, my children spend all their weekend time with me, practically. I'm taking them places, or we're hanging out, or we're all going places together. It's just a different way of living.
I've had this issue. I go to Fairfax to see my boyfriend on Saturdays sometimes. I live in Silver Spring, and there's all this traffic. And I'm like, why is there all this traffic? He's like, well, this is all the parents like taking their kids to soccer practice or to this or to that, which is not something that I was familiar with encountering. Let's take a call from Paul in Rockville, Maryland. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A lot of what I was going to say has been said. I was raised where we would leave on a Saturday morning on our bikes at whatever, 8 o'clock, and mom would say, okay, see you when you get home, which would be dark, and no big deal. And now I've raised three successful, one's a college rising senior, the other two are already out of college, and I think it struck a medium between helicopter and satellite, because you have to be somewhere in between. And another gentleman said, it's okay if you scratch your knee. I've told my students and my kids for years, I will let you scratch your knee, but I will not let you fall off a cliff. And that's what you have to define. But the main point I want to make is just that part of the perceived threat, I think, is a function of a 24-hour news cycle. And then the thing that you just mentioned about class is germane as well, because most of the folks who are into this helicopter mentality are the ones who have 24-hour news cycles, whether it's listening to NPR to and from work, or whether it's putting on Fox at home or CNN at home or something like that. And so all of this stuff through the digital age is constantly in front of us, whether it's an abduction in Texas or Massachusetts or here, everyone in the whole country is going to hear about it. And that's something that we didn't have when we were growing up. And that's about it. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks very much, Paul. Hannah, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, two responses. I think his approach is the right approach. In other words, to strike a balance, not to go back to the 70s when a lot of people felt neglected, but to do something, as he puts it, between helicopter and hovering. Take advantage of the new closeness with their children, but use it for a different effect. And the second thing I would say is that maybe it's just a matter of being aware of our assumptions and challenging them. So, we also have this 24-hour news cycle. It's in our heads. Like we said, there's an abduction story now in D.C. We're going to hear about it all the time. Then don't immediately assume that your child is in danger. Sort of let there be a little pause between
right.
what you're reading and how you behave in life.
So we have a couple of calls regarding schools in particular. And I'd like to start with Jill from McLean. Jill, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. And thank you, Hannah, for your article. I wanted to tell you a little bit about my children went to a school. My daughter's still enrolled. My son is in public school now, called the Eastern Ridge School. It's a small school in Northern Virginia. And we actually, the children have enormous amounts of unstructured play during the day. And there's a loose parts shade garden, and there's tires and a mud pit. And the families are kind of going against the grain, especially in the hyper-competitive Fairfax County. and you won't find worksheets and things like that. And we have a saying called, there's no bad weather, only bad clothing. So it's a really exciting place to have our kids. It's also sometimes hard with, you know, the community around us. And, you know, we have these open houses and parents come and they say, you really? They do this? And they, you know, they work with drills and things like that. So your article was a breath of fresh air, and we're hoping that more people will come on board and see the good stuff we're doing.
Thanks for calling, Jill. And we also have an email from Rusty who says, I wanted to let you know about a new adventure playground in the USA. Woohoo! It's the Hands-On Nature Anarchy Zone at the Ithaca Children's Garden in Ithaca, New York. We're starting our third year. It's a quarter acre, natural landscape, lots of loose parts and tools with trained play workers and a tool shed. Kids can dig in the mud, build forts, climb trees, make mud pies, etc. All free, unstructured play. So it sounds like there is, both from Jill's call and what Rusty's saying, a movement maybe coming together?
Yeah, and it like the Beauvoir Playground, like these two examples. I wish my kids went to that Virginia School of Play.
Sounds great.
Exactly. But I think it has to do with the DIY movement and environmentalism. You know, there's a way in which what I'm saying speaks naturally to trends that are out there anyway. You know, loose parts, build things ourselves. We don't want anything prefab. You know, I think these are all values generally in our culture that we respect. And so there's a way in which you can make the turn fairly easily, at least when it comes to play.
We still have a bunch of calls we're going to take, but if you'd like to get in towards the end of our conversation here, you can. You can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850. I'd like to give you the results of our poll so far, looking at whether or not kids are overprotected and what people think. The one question that has a very strong result is the question, are kids overprotected today? 3% say yes, and that's a good thing. 5% say no. 6% say they're not sure. And 87% say yes, and that's a bad thing. So it sounds like you're getting a kind of positive response to the point that
you're
making.
That's great. I'm popular today.
Not necessarily a counterpoint, but something to go along with the other side of this is a call that we have from Stephen in Rockville, Maryland. Stephen, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Just quickly, I've been involved in playgrounds and building them for 30 years, having been risk manager for the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission, Loudoun County Public Schools, done pro bono work with churches and schools in the area in building their playground. First thing is we have to build the playgrounds by the instructions and regulations set forth by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So they have a whole raft of regulations. Second is the tremendous amount of litigation that recreation and playgrounds bring to local governments, schools, states. And I have, over the years, been in many, many court suits that if little Johnny or little Jane is hurt in the playground, the parents are going to sue. And it costs $5,000 just to start to defend a case. So that's one of the things we have to work out, that I'm glad all these people say, oh, yes, please build me this natural playground like I had when I was a kid. But if their children get hurt, they will sue.
Stephen, I'm glad you brought this up because, Hannah, you actually raise an interesting point in your article about how it really was lawsuits in the 70s, and you cite one in particular that spurred this change to safer, maybe more boring, less creative playgrounds.
Yeah, the caller just described the cycle that happened that led to the boring playgrounds. The one thing I would take issue with, and he knows what he's talking about much more than I do when he has much more experience, you don't actually have to follow those recommendations. They're not laws. They're just recommendations. So why did the Beauvoir, you know, it takes a lot of work to push back against this culture of parents suing, and not everyone can do it, but you can do it. It's not illegal to do it. It's just that, you know, we get infected in our heads, oh my God, lawsuits and the parents are going to sue. So it's like it requires a whole cultural shift on the part of parents and institutions, which a few manage to do.
Let's take a call from Daniel in Rockville, Maryland. Daniel, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Hannah, great article. I'm a 34-year-old, so I just missed the millennial cutoff. I have two very young children. Another way to look at evidence of the trends you described in the article is the culture, the literature I remember growing up with, the movies that created, that told of an oppositional dynamic between children and parents, parents being somewhat skeptical of kids and kids always yearning to separate from parents. I just wonder if we'll see evidence of all of this in the lack of that kind of narrative anymore. How can there be that traditional oppositional kind of narrative when parents are immersed in every facet of kids' lives and making a whole host of things easier for them and more comfortable for them? You'll lose that breakfast club type of parents stink type of narrative, for lack of a better term. Thanks for taking the call.
Thanks, Daniel.
I think it's a matter of shifting slightly in the other direction. Like I said, I think the closeness between parents and children has yielded a lot of really good and positive results, particularly for little kids. But I always laugh when, you know, people say my kid is bored in school or, you know, my kid's mad at me. It's like, isn't that how it's supposed
right.
to be? You know, you got to give kids a little space to rebel against you and rebel against institutions and find them boring and annoying, you know, not always to find them lovely and pleasant. That's part of finding your own identity.
So in the minute that we have left, I just want to step back and take a slightly different perspective on this. We kind of see a cycle, right? During World War II and after, there were concerns about mothers going to work. And then that gave rise to the latchkey kids, which was a big concern in, I think, for a long time, but certainly in the 70s and 80s. And now we're maybe looking back on that phenomenon of unsupervised time with some nostalgia. So you can you just give us a kind of quick perspective of how this fits in the grander scheme of trends?
Yeah, we ride the waves in childhood. I think we go through extremes. You know, there's Dr. Spock then telling people to,
right.
you know, be freer. And then before that, it's like you have to have a tight hold or refrigerator moms. I mean, I think if you look back at the decades, we tend to wave between overparenting, underparenting. The other thing that we do is criticize ourselves,
sure.
you know, which is what I'm doing and which is what we're doing now. That is also typical of every age where parents turn the mirror on themselves and say, this is what we're doing wrong. And that's going to produce kids who are, you know, whatever, attached, sissies, whatever is the language of the era. We worry about the kids becoming that.
Right. This has been a fascinating conversation. Apologies to all of the callers that we couldn't get to. I've been talking with Hannah Rosen. She's a national correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine, author of the article The Overprotected Kid, and the book The End of Men. I'm Jen Golbeck, sitting in on the Kojo Namdi Show. Thanks for listening. Coming up tomorrow on the Politics Hour, D.C.'s Democrats gear up for the final stretch of the mayoral race. Maryland tries to accelerate enrollment in its health exchange before the sign-up deadline, and the Virginia General Assembly shifts into an overtime session. The Politics Hour, tomorrow at noon on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org. And for listeners in Ocean City, Maryland, it's Coastal Connection with Brian Russo.
Today's programs are made possible in part by David Shee, in celebration of award-winning performer Jill Wagner.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.